Good morning, y'all, and welcome finally to our highly coveted episode on Gingerbread by Helen Oyeyemi. Hello, and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Keep your bookmarks in place for now, but I do have a few announcements to start off with, namely that I'm going to start publishing weekly DH&I episodes, so the podcast will no longer be bi-weekly, but you guessed it, weekly, and I'm moving the publishing day to Monday mornings because I think we all need a bit more Monday love in our lives. This change does mean that instead of 6 episodes every other month, I'm going to be publishing straight 4 every month. So in the April in Paris series next month, there will be 4 episodes instead of the planned 6. Another change I want to introduce is that I want to stretch series out over a longer period of time. We are already doing this with the Didion series over the whole year this year, and you guys helped me out with picking Didion for that, so thanks. I'm going to introduce this with a new poetry series, starting with Shakespeare in about 3 weeks. So I'll be reviewing periodically a bit of poetry for the entire year, maybe longer. Suffice to say that I'm revamping DH&I's platform a bit to create a more balanced repertoire of episodes, one that hopefully pleases y'all as much as it has for me in the planning phase thus far. Gingerbread by Helen Oyeyemi was published 2 weeks ago on March 5th, 2019. It sits firmly in the literary fiction hyphen fairy tale genre. I must admit that as per usual with new books, I didn't really seek a summary or background information on it before reading, which was actually a decision I quite came to regret in regards to this novel in particular. Don't get me wrong here, this is not a read my lips, no new taxes moment, but the novel, including the storyline and writing style, has a very niche target audience, which is a tidbit of information that I do wish with retrospect to have known beforehand. The 1 minute summary. The novel follows Harriet Lee through many different frame narrations to propose a modern retelling of the fairy tale Hansel and Gretel. Harriet is famous for her gingerbread and uses it both to spoil her daughter Perdita and as bait for trying to get on her daughter's school's PPA. Early on in domestic struggle, though, and simultaneously early on in the novel, Perdita bakes a batch of gingerbread that ostensibly comes off as a suicide attempt in the real world, though mother and daughter both know that Perdita has actually found her way back to her mother's home country, Jerusalem, bringing back a ring from the mysterious Gretel Kercheval, Harriet's elusive and emblematic childhood friend, who seems to somehow indirectly influence all of Harriet's decisions to date, though they haven't contacted each other for decades. Interesting, and honestly a bit perplexing to me as a linguistics nerd, is the detail that after the bad batch of gingerbread, Perdita persists with neurological speech impediments, making her production and understanding of communication very difficult. The reason why it's perplexing to me is because the majority of the book from here on out is an oral history of Harriet's life, told to her daughter from herself and her magical plant dolls over the course of an entire evening. So even withstanding the frequent breaks in the narration, it's unclear how much benefit Perdita is getting out of the tale, especially considering how easily exhausted she rightfully should have been after even an hour of such in-depth conversation. Magic. Anywho, Harriet comes from the Drossenen farmstead, an incredibly poor community that reminds me of early US sharecropping in that the farmers, despite working day in and day out, are constantly climbing into deeper and deeper graves of debt. At the same time, however, there's a wealthy community of individuals who seem to treat money as novel, as there's big emphasis on the ridiculous lottery system, etc., etc. Margot, Harriet's mother, is from the big city and eventually convinces a woman to bring select children from the farmstead into the city to serve as gingerbread girls, where they eat properly for the first time in their lives and get up to some sketchy city business. In the interest of time, I am surface skimming a bit, but along the way, Harriet meets Gretel, the daughter of the wealthy woman who brought the farmstead girls into the city, and together they uncover the fact that Gretel's mother has been paying the girls with fake money, entrenching a great distrust in already hardened Harriet. It is around this time that Harriet also begins to educate herself, learning English for the first time and excelling in practically everything she can get her hands on. Needless to say, she leaves the gingerbread girl enterprise and travels with her mother to England, where she stays and works for the Kershevals, the Lees' wealthy cousins. Particularly important to the gist of the plot are brothers Gabriel and Remy Kirschival. Both, as I gathered, have had romantic trysts with Harriet in the past, and big reveal, Gabriel is Perdita's father, making her half Lee and half Kirschival, which is important. The last bit of the book is extremely nuanced, and in an effort not to botch the plot completely, I'm going to leave you with the loose ends that the rest of the book attempts to reconcile and get straight away into the analysis. Let's first start out with what I really enjoyed about the novel. We all know how much of a sucker for frame narrations I am, and the storyline has several, including an added frame that gets introduced with the last lines of the book that I don't want to spoil, obviously, for those of you who are planning on reading it. Frames come directly from the 1800s romantic period in literature, so I can't get enough of it when frames, especially to this degree, are introduced in modern work. Also, they are quite a bit to keep track of oftentimes, and I like having to work a little bit to understand the nuances of the plot as I did here. Secondly, the novel was socially super different than the ones that I'm used to reading, and of course, as I say this, no one, including myself, is surprised because I'm obsessed with classics, but every person in the class of this novel is Black, and as well, a majority of the characters are bisexual or gay, so I absolutely got the sense while I was reading of this no-nonsense, we are not in Kansas anymore, but rather the 21st century theme, and overall, I enjoyed kind of the literary slap in the face that I got from the novel, especially since it was so opposite from the ones I normally keep on my bedside table. I have a friend, actually, and hi Claire if you're listening, who goes out of her way to read more diverse literature and to challenge herself both topically and in terms of the authors she's reading, and while committing to that kind of whirlwind of literary achievement is a far-fetched goal for me at this point in time, just in terms of what I have yet to get through and also, frankly, what I enjoy reading. My bookshelf is definitely not an all-white cast, by the way. I think some of the most brilliant work of all time is international, but two things arise from this conversation. One, thank you, Claire, for putting the idea in all of our radars, and I commend your intuition and curiosity and respect for the unknown. And two, in general, it is important to push your boundaries, especially in terms of intellectual range, but take care not to burn out or stretch yourself too much in the process, because without sprinkling in work that you really love in the midst of exploration, you may find that you've lost your way in terms of the true volume of what is out there to read and subsequently enjoy. I experienced a very similar phenomenon when I started listening to jazz really seriously for the first time. I have a radio show on WNUR 89.3 FM. That is my one and only plug of the day. But I started listening to all of this wonderful music, and I just very quickly got overwhelmed as to what I indeed was looking for and listening to in jazz. So I did have to end up dialing back a bit and going back to the classics and listening, okay, I really like jazz piano, like I'll go for Keith Jarrett or I'll go for Bill Evans, rather than trying to figure out Herbie Hancock's full list of albums in the 1960s, so. Literarily, Okeyami also makes a few unconventional moves that I quite enjoyed while working my way through. One of them is that in the inner frame, she decides to introduce the minor motivating characters, the Kirschivals, all at once in the form of a ranking as to who is most readable to Harriet. So the characters and their descriptions are all in one place in the middle of the novel. I thought that this edition was so unique in that we as readers aren't going through and meeting the characters one by one chronologically, but rather coming across a pocket of their descriptions and characterizations. There were, of course, contrarily, some things that I did not like about the novel, and they are 287% my own personal opinion, but I will quickly enumerate them here. The plotline is incredibly slow, as most of it takes place in the form of a bedtime conversation, as I mentioned, with frequent interjections from Perdita and her semi-conscious dolls. It makes me think of Barber's operas, when he writes about sitting on porches and drinking tea. That state, while beautiful to observe on brief intervals, is not my favorite to sit sweltering in. The novel is mostly dialogue as well, and dialogue within dialogue at that. She uses italics to differentiate the dialogue in the inner frame from dialogue in the outer frame, and makes some cool formatting moves, but personally I tend to gravitate towards a very specific and pointed, straight to the point kind of dialogue that wasn't really present in the novel at all. Dialogue is also one of the hardest things to write because it's literally impossible to create naturally occurring utterances in an artificial context such as a fiction book, unless you literally record two people pretending to be the characters talking and then write down verbatim what they say. I mean, there are whole courses you can take about dialogue and character development and all of that jazz. It's not to say, though, that I thought the dialogue was poorly written or horrendous or anything like that. It just wasn't my cup of tea, especially in the quantities that it was present. The characterization in the novel really irked me because there honestly wasn't much there to dissect, especially in regards to major characters like Gabriel and Perdita. I read this novel quite carefully and quite slowly, and still came out feeling like I don't truly know any of the characters save for Harriet, who is tasked with narrating almost the entire novel. In addition, the list format that I mentioned earlier, while enjoyable for its unusual placement and characteristics, didn't give me the kind of insight that I really needed on the Kercheval's, indeed also considering the amount of space that the descriptions ended up filling in the novel. A good indicator of character development for me is if I can put myself in that character's shoes while they're narrating, if I feel that I can understand at least a bit about their perspective or in another capacity, if I can feel that I can determine perhaps what decisions they would make in certain contexts. Needless to say, I had a really hard time doing these things with the characters in this novel. Also, I typically love magical realism, not only reading it, but playing around with writing in it as well, and I think that the fairy tale aspects took it too far into fantasy for me personally to enjoy. I suppose what bothers me about pseudo-fantasies like this one is that when there are loose ends, they are usually explained away by the fact that magic exists, almost as an excuse for not coming to a true resolution. So I guess I should turn this comment into a two-for-one. The ending was another thing I didn't quite like because too many elements were introduced in the last 40 pages alongside the wrap-up. I can definitely see that that happened at least in part because the inner frame came to a close within that time, so there was an effort to make the events of the book's present time frame as eventful and busy as the book's past time frame, but in my opinion, that came to be overwhelming because I just mentioned it was double the amount of things to resolve in an amount of time that was proportionately unreasonable to attempt, leading to the because magic explanation. All of that being said, however, I want to end on a bit of information on the author herself so that we don't harp on the negative too much, especially since this is my second review of the year. Oyeyemi actually reportedly wrote her first book, Icarus Girl, when she was in the middle of completing her A-levels, which are, as I understand it, similar to AP exams, but in Britain. It is super impressive that she was able to craft something as difficult as a novel during one of the busiest times in her career academically, so that is definitely a tidbit worth mentioning and heralding. She is also quite decorated as a novelist with several awards under her belt, including the highly coveted Penn Open Book Award for her short story collection, What Is Not Yours Is Not Yours. Other highly inventive books by Oyeyemi include Boy Snowbird and Mr. Fox. Overall, though Gingerbread is not my favorite read of the year thus far, its modern revamping of traditional fairy tale norms makes it a read worth looking through in the context of 2019's new releases. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there's an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes. If you need some guidance, try the last episode about love. I'm really proud of it, and I don't know why. I just really love sitting down and making that for y'all. And by the way, I finally made it to home base in Arizona, so I'm definitely spending this week in a comatose state, as you can probably tell from my lackluster diction. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Jones Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net. And remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Our next episode will be in 6 days' time. It will be about uncovering New York Times bestsellers. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!